All right, so like I said, life goes on, and so does our investigation of the foundations of animal behavior. So we just finished with behavioral genetics in the previous unit, and now we're here to talk about learning and cognition in this unit. So we're going to start out with learning and memory. So we'll have three lectures, and then we'll move on to cognition at the end. So we'll sort of get closer and closer to cognition as we go from this lecture to the next lecture, and finally then rounding up with cognition, whatever that means, cognition. So just getting the eye clicker working here. So you'll notice in this one, we'll actually have more eye clickers than usual, and that is intentional. For reasons that we'll see if you pick up on. So let's move forward. Announcements here is, because we've just finished the AREB, or sorry, Unit B, then the reading assignment and the Canvas exercise for Unit B will be due this Sunday, this weekend. And because we're starting Unit C, then, but Unit C is three lectures long, then next weekend, because we'll do this today, Thursday, right? Today, Tuesday, and Thursday, that will be all of Unit C. So that's why it's due then next Sunday. So that's the schedule there. Okay, so let's start with an eye clicker just to get our juices flowing. All right, so their question, there's a causal question. How are memories stored? So would we call that, if you think about Tinbergen's four causes, Tinbergen's four levels of explanation, do you think this causal question comes from the mechanism group, the phylogeny group, the ontogeny group, or the function group? What type of question is it? Is it a question about mechanism, a question about phylogeny, a question about ontogeny, or a question about function? How are memories stored? So go ahead and give that a shot. See how we're doing. All right, so we're getting right now it's sort of a bimodal distribution where most are answering mechanism. There are a low level of phylogeny, ontogeny, and then a secondary peak at function. So it's an interesting spread here. So the reasoning here is where when you ask a how question, how is usually your cue that things are going to be more proximate. So a how question is less about costs and benefits, but it's more about exactly how it works. So with that in mind, I would say that, it's probably not function, because function almost always gets answered or gets asked with a why. Why do we have memory? Why are memories stored this way? So if there are multiple ways you could store memories, why in this animal was it selected for to store it this way? Those would be why questions. Those would be functional questions. But a how question suggests probably not D. So when we see that how, then we start looking at these other ones. Phylogeny, that is at an evolutionary time scale. And so this doesn't seem like it's talking about how things evolved. So it's probably not that type of how. Ontogeny is developmental. Any question about learning is always going to be a little confusing, because learning is a developmental process, really. It's a life history process. And so, in fact, a lot of psychologists will talk about ontogenetic factors in learning and phylogenetic factors in learning, sort of like what's learning across species and what's learning, over a life history. So in some ways, whenever you hear somebody ask a question about learning, it's always kind of confusing whether it's a developmental question or not. But I would say that in this case, when you say how are memories stored, you're really talking about not like, when do you get the ability to learn, or when does memory start showing up in your life history? It's really like, if you have a new memory, is it in your stomach? Is it in your arm? Is it in your head? If it's in your head, where is it in your head? How long does it stick around? What's causing it to stick around? What's causing it to stay put? Those are mechanisms. So you could say, like, what genes are involved, what pathways are involved, those sorts of hypotheses. Like, I think that, as an example, there's a guy I know who's a developmental biologist, and he was interested in, he heard that moose, if you their antlers, if you take a, if they get you know a, them you know if you take a knife, but in the wild, if they get scratched on one of those antlers, then when they drop their antlers, when they grow new antlers, they'll get a new tine where that scratch is. And he is the type of person who studies developmental biology, but from kind of a memory specific angle. And so he then was going to then propose work to Gesundheit to study that process of how does it know where to put that new tine after it drops its antlers? Where is that memory stored? And interestingly enough, so when you propose work with vertebrates, you have to get a veterinarian involved in order to approve your plan for taking care of the vertebrates. And they said, well, you can't just go and take a conscious moose and cause damage to its antlers. You're going to have to put it to sleep. But when they did the research, they found out that when a moose is unconscious, the effect goes away. So an unconscious moose, if you damage its antlers, when it drops its antlers, it won't form a new tine there at that point. So so there's a lot of so there certainly are developmental questions that could be asked there. Just the mechanism of, well, where the heck is that memory being stored? Like when you cause that trauma, where does it go? And now that you know that it has to be conscious to go there, then that hints at it, well, maybe it involves the brain or something like that. So those are, I would say, are kind of mechanistic questions, that you're asking. Exactly where in the body, where in the animal, where in the environment, where is that memory? So I would call that a mechanistic question. Is that clear? Any questions about that? A how question, typically how is going to be like, very often it's mechanism or phylogeny. How did it evolve or how does it work? Often, sometimes it also, because ontogeny is pretty proximate too, then you can phrase things in terms of how questions here and ontogeny, but almost never do you say how and it links to function. Okay, let's try. And I think I've got one more. In fact, I know I've got one more. So I'm going to reset the eye clicker and go to the next one here. So just one more for now. New question, why do animals learn? What type of causal question is this? So go ahead and give that a shot. A, mechanism, B, phylogeny, C, ontogeny, D, function. Is this a question about a mechanism, about phylogeny, about ontogeny, or about function? The why question of why do animals learn? So after that last discussion, and it should have given some hints here. And so right now we've got a strong mode at function, and then a little side lobe at ontogeny, and then a couple of phylogeny and mechanisms here. So again, the trick, or the not the trick, but the key here is the why question. Why questions are, I mean, there are ways to phrase these questions. Usually there's ways to kind of do a little bit of manipulation and turn how questions into why questions and why questions into how questions. But usually the most natural way to ask functional questions is why. Why do harvester ants on the East Coast, when you deplete all their foragers, not ramp up their foraging production? But on the West Coast, when you deplete all their foragers, respond to the forager depletion to ramping up forager production. Why is that the case? Why do we see that difference? Is there an adaptive value to having the adaptive demographics on the West Coast but not on the East Coast? So those are the why questions. Why might that be? So when we see why, we normally think function. If you feel pulled towards one of these, then you just have to be careful. There are, again, ways to phrase things. How questions is why questions is how questions. But, the answer to this question doesn't presuppose any particular mechanism. The answer to this question isn't, you could say, well, why do animals learn? You could answer that with, well, animals learn because the last common ancestor of, animals and fungus learned. And it was, and so, but that would be a phylogenetic answer. So that doesn't answer the functional question of, okay, so, but, what's maintaining the learning in the population? And, but you could say phylogenetically that, oh, well, it's, you're going to see a strong learning signal among all animals because all animals had a common ancestor that learned. So there are ways to phrase this where they could be answered by phylogenetic hypotheses, but the phylogenetic hypotheses don't preclude functional hypotheses. So you don't want to confound the two. You can be investigating it phylogenetically. Where did it come from evolutionarily? But you can also be investigating what function does it provide? And those two things, they might inform each other, but they all don't have to sit on top of each other. Is that clear? Any questions about that? So I would say my gut for why do animals learn is function. Most of the answers I have to that are functional, but it would be easy for me to get tripped up because, you could answer that with a phylogenetic explanation as well. And I'd say, oh, that's the phrasing you're asking. So if you're asking phylogenetic questions, it's usually good to phrase them so there's less ambiguity. And if I asked you something like this on a test, I'd be sure to give you a causal question that wouldn't have that ambiguity. But the causal question things, like when we beat up on grad students and their comprehensive exams, we force them to write out their causal questions. But in reality, if you read papers, hypotheses dominate. Every hypothesis has a causal question, and if you beat up on someone enough, you can get them to burp out what that causal question is. But really, where science lives is in the hypotheses. But the causal questions remind us that there can be hypotheses at the level of phylogeny that are totally separate from hypotheses at the level of function, and they don't have to be linked. Okay. Any questions? Yep. Well, so again, learning is one of these things where always you can pull you towards ontogeny because learning is you develop skills over time. But typically, and this is just a convention, that's what we're trying to teach here, is that typically when we phrase causal questions with a why, we will try to put it in terms of function. Now, if we wanted to ask a developmental question, we often would ask that in terms of how. Or we would be more specific about why. Well, it's hard because usually why is answered by like what benefit does it give you or what cost does it avoid? But a developmental question like how does color vision develop? Like it might be that when you're under a certain age, you can't see color, and then when you're over that age, you do see color. And then you'd say, well, what developmental mechanism is causing you to see color in one and another? That would be a developmental question, and it's easier to phrase as a how question. I'm not saying why it's good to see black and white when you're young and why it's good to see color when you're old. So that's the why. Why is it good or bad? That's a why. How does it work? That's, these other ones. Yeah, I mean, again, it's how it's phrased. But yeah, usually how questions are going to be the first guess with a how question is probably mechanism, but if it's how, but then the context of the question is over evolutionary timescales, it's probably phylogeny. If it's how and it's over life history, so it's over like years of a life, it's probably developmental. Yeah, timescale is a great way to sort these out. Any other questions about that, causal or otherwise? Okay, great. So that sets up our learning here. So why do animals learn? Claim here, that's ultimate causation. That is functional. And function either involves benefits or costs. So this is the tricky thing. When you first learn this stuff, you want every why question to be about benefits. Why is it beneficial for X or Y? But if you ask a question about costs, or again, going back to hypotheses really being the driver, if your hypothesis involves a cost, not a benefit, it's still functional. So you could say that, you can ask questions about not just why a trait provides an advantage, but why a trait is providing a disadvantage, why it would be selected against. Like you could say, you could have there's a hypothesis that being brightly colored, being a brightly colored moth in a world of dark trees, puts you at a selective disadvantage. So that would suggest then that predict that the white coloration would be selected out. So there, I'm speaking about costs, and that speaking about costs, that is also should be like it's ultimate causation. So if you hear someone talking about a hypothesis or a question that is benefits or costs, either one is functional. So it's still regarding the relative function of that trait versus another trait. That's ultimate. Now, when we're talking about learning, we could say, well, what influences the benefits and costs of different learning traits? And the environment is a major modulator of that. It informs those things. When you talk, we talk a lot about honeybees, because I study social insects, I study ants primarily. Sean studies honeybees, so it's I'm sitting here. I always my examples go there at least this semester because I think that Sean's sitting there. But when you talk about honeybees, a worker may only live a month, but they don't know what month they're born in, and so they have to very quickly learn what flowers are in bloom that month. And so knowing the phenology, knowing the timing of things that are in bloom, tells us something about the need or the benefit of being able to learn if you're a honeybee in an environment that is very variable, where you only live in a short term and you don't know when you're going to be brought forth into the world. Is it going to be a lily time of the year, or is it going to be a rose time of the year or something like that? So the environment and the ecology informs benefits and costs, generally speaking. But once we have benefits and costs, then it's tempting to ask other questions about, well, how are those memories stored? If you've shown that an animal has the ability to form this interesting memory, like the moose, somehow it's it can grow this tine at where it's gotten this trauma on its antlers, even after it's dropped its antlers, when it regrows those antlers, then he's like, well, where is that stored? How is that stored? So that's a mechanism there. Now, there can be information that goes back and forth to these things too. Like once you learn something about the mechanism, then you might learn that, wow, that storage mechanism is really costly. It is metabolically costly. Every bit of information that is stored via that mechanism burns a lot of energy. And so that then, then relates to costs, and that can tell you about why certain animals may not have the ability to learn while others do. Certain animals may have enough energy around that they can do that learning. It pays off based on the ecology, but other animals, it's just not worth paying that cost, and so you don't learn. So knowing how costly the mechanism is, so we bounce back and forth between the levels when we're doing these investigations. We only do one at a time, but as we learn about one, it suggests questions of the other. Likewise, once we know about the mechanisms, then we can ask about development. Like and say, huh, in order to do this learning, you must have this particular part of the brain. Well, that part of the brain isn't really available. Like it doesn't really develop until a particular maturation stage. So do we predict then that the learning won't show up until later? Then we can start doing those, now that we know the mechanism and we know that that mechanism isn't fully formed until later, it suggests developmental experiments that we can do. So these things are all informing each other. And then, as you notice variation across species, that always then, oh, and then, yeah, sorry, I skipped. So, ontogeny can also inform then benefits. Because again, this is like knowing something about the mechanism. So, knowing that a bird, knowing about when a bird's chicks have the ability to walk away gives you information about how useful it is for you to learn the faces of your own chicks to prevent other chicks from stealing food from you. So you probably don't need to learn the faces of the chicks that are really young, because really young chicks aren't walking around. But once they get a certain age, then it's really important to do that. So the developmental questions then can inform the benefits and cost questions. And then as you look across species and notice differences, then you start wondering, Are those differences new? Did they pop out of thin air? Were they inherited from a common ancestor? How did these things evolve? Are they just baggage? Are they phylogenetic inertia? Like when my dog spins in place, he doesn't get any benefit out of spinning in place before he lays down. But once upon a time, there was some proto wolf that spun in place. And as it spun in place, it got all the things that, could sting it and so on. And maybe it cooled down the earth or whatever. It provided some benefit. And now it's actually more costly to get rid of this kind of neutral behavior than to keep it. So dogs spin in place, even though it doesn't provide any functional value. So, then we could start asking phylogenetic questions as we start looking at the diversity of behaviors across species. And we can do that for learning too. So you can notice that some animals are better at maze solving than others. And so that amazing result, where did it come up to play? Like, why is this branch of the tree of life crappy at learning? And why is this branch really good at learning? In terms of, not in terms of function, but in terms of descent. So we can ask lots of questions about learning from a behavioral perspective. So, what is learning? Any questions about this idea that these questions at any one study is only going to focus on one thing? And now a paper might have multiple studies in it, but you don't confound these things. You don't say that the reason why you learn is it's not like you're doing the functional math and saying today's a good day to learn because of the ecology. I know that right now I should turn on my learning, but tomorrow maybe I'll turn off my learning. That could be a hypothesis for how learning works, but that would not sort of fit Occam's razor. Like that would sort of be, there are probably more parsimonious explanations that we can separate out the function at an evolutionary time scale with the mechanism at the today time scale. So we do studies at the four levels, but then the results of the studies inspire new studies potentially at other levels. So you are allowed to do work across all four levels, but whenever you're doing work at a particular study, you're working within a level. So that clear? All right. So, and I beat you over head with this because of learning curves, which we're just about to learn about. It takes a while to learn things. So what is learning? Learning is a change of behavior as a part of experience. We use the term plasticity. Something that is plastic is you deform it and it doesn't go back. Something that's elastic, you deform it and it snaps back in place. If it's plastic, it remembers that experience. So the bent plastic fork will be a bent plastic fork for the rest of its life. It has learned the to the trauma of being bent like that. And so that's what we mean by plasticity. When we talk about learning in the brain, changes in the brain, plastic deformations of the brain, then we refer to that as neuroplasticity. So that is the mechanisms in the brain that form memories. Those are those plastic deformations. We contrast that with innate behavior. So innate behavior is just a response to environmental cues. This you could sometimes think about as learning at an evolutionary time scale. Those that respond to the cues one way in one environment may be selected for or selected against. And you're sort of learning the right cues by filtering out those that have innate behaviors for the wrong cues. But the learning isn't happening at a life history scale. It's just responding to those cues. Whenever a gull sees the orange beak of its mother, then it opens its mouth. That is an innate behavior. You can take a baby gull and you can show it a pencil with a kind of a beak-shaped eraser that has the right orange dot on it, and it will open its mouth at that. It doesn't have to learn that that's the right time to open its mouth. That is an innate response. So we contrast that. The innate behaviors that you just get, you don't doesn't take any time for them, and then the learned behaviors, which you don't have out of the box, but then gradually you get them. So that gets to that learning curve that I was just talking about. Learning generally isn't instantaneous. There are special cases, but in most cases, you have to get some sort of reward or reinforcement that we'll talk about that gives you information, and that information eventually sticks over time. So if you pick things up quickly, then there might be some things I'm like, why is he talking about this over and over? And it's because there's variation in learning curves. And so sometimes I repeat things over and over because some of us need that. And but then once we get it retains. Those that get things really quick might be those that lose things really quick. And so that inertia that's in your head, can go the other way as well. So, the advantage you have in picking things up might be a disadvantage in how quickly you forget them. It might be, that's a hypothesis. But the point is, rarely does an animal of any type learn something the first try. It usually takes time. Learning is hard, which is why we study, which is why we practice, which is why, lectures are 75 minutes and not 15 minutes, So that's what we talk about learning. Any questions about plasticity? This term, is that pretty clear what I mean by plastic deformation? It's the fancy way that we talk about learning. Okay, so honeybees, again, these are example learning curves this is learning curves from Sean's advisor back in the 90s, where these are real data. And so I don't have to talk about the actual experiment here. But the point that this is driving home is you have different groups of bees that were presented with odors that were rewarded. And over time, they learn that when an odor that was paired with a reward is presented alone, then they start sticking out their tongues to try to get what they think. I mean, the mech, so that I just confounded things there. I'm not saying that like it's as if they anticipated sticking out their tongue because the reward is coming, but there is a mechanism that has the functional benefit that if they stick out their tongue when that odor is presented, then they often get the reward. And so that's what we're seeing here is that there's this proboscis extension response. So you take little honeybees like this, you put them in soda straws, you put a little tape behind the honeybee. So here's a bunch of honeybees and a bunch of soda straws. And so this is what it looks like on top here. And then this is their little proboscis, their tongue, and they will stick it out under certain conditions. And so they can learn to stick it out under unnatural conditions. And you can then say, how often did they stick out their tongue? And so initially, you give them an odor that they aren't familiar with, and they don't ever stick out their tongue. But as you train them, then you notice that over time, they learn that when that odor is presented, they should stick out their tongue. And different groups may have different learning curves. So then you can start asking, why does one group of bees have a slow learning curve and the other group of bees have a fast learning curve? And and by why there, I probably should have said how. So there's the why question of, could that provide a benefit to the colony to have some bees that are fast learners and some bees that are slow learners? But there's a how question of what are the mechanistic differences? Like if you unzip the bee and look inside it, then what makes a slow bee and what makes a fast bee a fast bee? Those are the mechanistic questions. But this is the phenotype, this learning curve. So learning curves also are paired with forgetting curves. So you can say, you can keep presenting the odor without a reward, and you can see, over time, over long periods of time, I'll test them next week, and I'll just present the odor. Did they stick it? Okay, I'll test them the next week. Did they stick out their tongue? And so then you can see how quickly they forget this. So with periodic reinforcement that can prevent losing the memory. So if you then occasionally give them the reward, then maybe they keep it. But if you don't give them reward, then over time, naturally, they might just forget it. There's also a related idea of an extinction curve where you can force them. You say, okay, now I'm actually going to give you the stimulus that used to be rewarded. I'm going to give it to you a lot, but not reward it. And now that I'm Now, how quickly do you learn that this stimulus that you used to trust had a reward now doesn't have a reward? And they're similarly shaped and they're very closely related, these forgetting and extinction curves. But it's just sort of the flip side, the back end of a learning curve. Learning curve, how much experience do you need to learn something? Forgetting curve, how much time does it take to forget something? Questions about those concepts? Learning curves and forgetting curves? also a little confusing that learning curves, when they're steep, people say, oh, there's a steep learning curve. Well, that biologically, neurobiologically, a steep learning curve means it's actually easier to learn. But it sounds funny to say, like, oh, wow, that class was so hard, or I had a really shallow learning curve. It just doesn't sound, so it sounds better to be steep learning curve. But in reality, a steep learning curve is one where after one or two trials, you got it. So that's the easier task. But that's where this term, that steep, comes from. It comes from this idea of these learning curves, the steepness of how quickly it's learned or how quickly it's forgotten. All right. So these are, again, from real studies here, these learning curves. Now, when we talk about learning, so any questions about the learning curve? Are these structures, do they make sense? So trials or time on the x-axis, response on the right, on the y-axis. It's just a way to measure learning phenotypes. The trial. So how often? So let's give you a test now. Okay, you didn't respond. Okay, let's now give you the trial. Now let's give you the trial. How long does it take for you to actually do it? Start doing it. Okay. When we talk about learning, it's entwined with memory. So we not only can test how quickly you learn something, but how you retain it. And so, this is a study of short-term memory, so a time scale here matters. And so the idea here is you look across different types, in this case of bees, and you say, 15 minutes ago, you 100% of the time would stick out your tongue when we gave you this odor. Now we've waited 15 minutes, you haven't experienced the odor or any rewards, then do you still do that behavior? Or has it declined? Now is it 80% instead of 100%? And so and then you can say, are there certain things that you have longer memories of than others? So we can ask lots of questions about short-term memory. So how quickly do things just naturally go away? So that's what we mean by short-term memory is, things that are forgotten quickly versus things that are automatically retained. So that suggests that we need to be talking about temporal scale in terms of learning, that that's somehow important. So that's where we're pivoting to next, is thinking about the neuron and short-term and long-term memory. So not a neurobiology course, so we're not going to go into a lot of this details. I'm going to mention axons and dendrites and synapses, but not expecting you to go back to be able to recall all of that information. But it's good context for thinking about costs, benefits, and mechanisms. Because, there is this question of, like, again, the mechanistic question. What is different between short-term memory and long-term memory? I might remember that there's an eraser on the floor, and so I will, step around it as I walk, as I pace back and forth, as I commonly do. But if I don't step around it for a little while, I might then trip over it a few minutes later because I, forgot about it. And it's like, I don't even remember remembering it. Why, so what's going on there versus remembering where this room is? And, so what's the difference in what's going on in my head or what's going on in my neurons? So, neurons are these networks, these cells, which have these bodies, these soma, these long pathways here, these axons. And there are these dendrites which connect to the end of the axon. So each neuron can create a network where it can gather input at this end, and then it can send signals down here that become input to other neurons downstream. It's the basic idea here. And the key thing that we focus on is the synapse. And so you've got up here, this is your dendrite. And this is your axon. So this is coming from here's the sort of soma, the kind of cell body of a upstream neuron or a presynaptic neuron. This is the synapse here. This is the gap between these neurons, and here's the dendrite that is down here. And it turns out, and I think somebody won a Nobel Prize for this, that you can see the mechanism of short-term and long-term memory right inside this cell. And so the idea here is that And you can investigate these things by knocking out different mechanisms inside the cell and seeing what happens to the animal. And you can cause, you can extinguish short-term memory while maintaining long-term memory, or vice versa, by playing with these things. And that would give you confirmation that you understand the mechanisms of these two memory sources. And the idea here is that you've got this cell. It's got a bunch of, it's basically just a bag of goo. It doesn't matter what's in that goo, but the important thing is that goo allows for signals to transmit down that long axon and then generate these neurotransmitters that go across this synapse into this dendrite to pass that information on. And so it's really all about, how sensitive are the things that are in this synapse right here. What happens in your short-term memory is that you get a recruitment of all of the things that make this synapse easier to fire. You get a recruitment of that inside the cell toward the synapses. So you get this, the synapse doesn't change physically, but its contents, you get a local clustering of all of those things that make the synapse a little more twitchy down here. And that makes this connection easier to fire for the short amount of time that things stay kind of clustered down here. And so that is going to happen on a scale of less than a second to seconds, maybe to minutes, but not longer than minutes. So that's how these short-term memories are. If I happen to trip over this thing, then there are going to be synapses that fire due to that stimulus of that are temporarily going to cause a restructuring inside my neurons, not of my neurons, that are going to cause me to remember for a few seconds that that thing was right there. Now, if I keep stubbing my toe on this thing, then eventually there's going to be a little flag that will be added to this synapse, to these neurons, that will, well, for one, it's going to help me remember that for a few more minutes. And so it'll keep happening that way. But what is going to happen is that that flag, when I go to sleep, that flag is going to cause my sleeping processes to engage in memory consolidation. And that is where we form long-term memory. And what's going to happen is that while I'm sleeping, all of these little tags, and there are other mechanisms that are similar to this, but same idea, all of these little tags are going to get visited by these processes that engage the nucleus of the cell. And so at this point, you're actually asking the neuron to build a more sensitive synapse. And so at that point, it said, wow, this synapse got triggered a bunch today. So rather than requiring the periodic reinforcement from getting my, toe stubbed by this, tomorrow I'm just going to know without getting my toe stubbed that this thing is here. Because I got my toe stubbed so often the previous day, this got marked. And then while I was sleeping, my neurons started to produce new proteins that reshaped this synapse, making the synapse at a more permanent level more sensitive. That's how we get long-term memory. The memory consolidation process going from short-term to long-term. So you've got minor changes inside cells for short-term memory. And then over the day, then those get tagged. And then those tags, through the process of memory consolidation, generally during sleep, get then turned into actual deformations of a synapse or even new synapses forming. And that then physical change means that you'll have that memory for longer than minutes to days. It might be days to months or even days to years. So that's the difference between short-term and long-term memory. Restructuring the synapse versus restructuring the stuff inside the cells. Questions about that? Very different mechanism, all located at the same point. And this is why sleep is important. Okay, so if we think about that, then we can think about the metabolic costs of these things, because we're behavioral ecologists, or at least I'm a behavioral ecologist. I'm convincing you it's a worthy field. And so behavioral ecologists ask questions about costs, not a physiologist. And so if we think about the costs here, the costs like while, I mean, it's not the cost, there's costs of like building an individual with innate behaviors. That's one thing. But like once the individual's built, what's the cost of maintaining that memory? And for an innate behavior, there's no plasticity. So whatever you're built with, you got it for free. You don't have to restructure anything. And so it's pretty cheap. Short-term memory, it's just a rejuggling of chemicals inside cells closer to synapses, but then they kind of bounce back. So that's not there's not a lot of metabolic load to just recruiting things toward a synapse and then letting them spring back. You're not actually building new cells. So it is more costly than innate because you got to move things around, but you're not restructuring the body. Long-term memory, you're actually restructuring the neurons. You're actually changing physical properties to make them permanent. And that requires, while you're sleeping, a lot of energy to be used to do that reshaping, to grow those parts of yourself or to cause some of them to rescind, but basically to change. So there's a lot of metabolic load there. And then there's, long-lasting memory. So this is not a term that a lot of neurobiologists will use, but it is a term you see in your book. And it's emphasizing that, there are extinction rates and forgetting rates for long-term memory. You don't automatically remember things for the rest of your life. And so if you want to remember something for the rest of your life, then you might need periodic reactivation or rehearsal to keep track of that. Now we're going to learn about something called imprinting that achieves that, but it achieves that using some pretty costly developmental mechanisms. So the point here is that, as you get from shorter to longer term, then you get a greater load. You pay more costs. You have to eat more muffins to remember things longer. And that should show up in why certain animals under certain conditions learn well and other animals under other conditions don't. So do you follow me about the metabolic costs here, that short-term memory is cheaper than long-lasting memory? And innate memory or innate behavior is sort of the cheapest on this scale. Okay, so then we have to ask, as behavioral ecologists, they cost the different amounts. What is their benefit? What do you get out of each one of them? In order to really understand the net benefit to you is benefit minus cost. And so we have to think about like, well, these exist at different time scales. So they're probably matched to how things change in the environment. Because if you think about it, innate behavior, well, if you have a really stable environment, why go through the process of building a learning engine when it's always going to be that way? If a bee always comes out of the hive and it's always the case that yellow flowers are in bloom and every yellow flower always has got nectar or pollen, then just go to the yellow flowers and just get an innate desire to go to yellow. Done. Don't have to learn anything. But if things change, then you do have to learn things. So if things are relatively stable, then we think that that probably has selective pressure against learning, because why learn something that's relatively stable? Now, then short-term memory, let's say you're hunting a prey item. You might want to remember that a prey item ran into that bush over there. So it's good to know that because then you can pursue that bush. You can wait for it to leave that bush. But is it useful to retain that for a day? Probably not, because that information goes stale after a day. So short-term memory is sort of a recognition that you pay a little bit of cost to gain benefit at short time scales, but it's not worth paying the cost to burn it into longer-term memory because it's just not useful later. So there you get kind of the balance in the selective pressures for these, chasing down a prey item is probably lined up more here, which is why we think we have working and short-term memory. But there are things that you probably need to remember things for days to months. It's good to know where your home is from days to months. You might move homes, so you might need to remember, be able to change that up. But that's one of the things that it's nice to not have to remind yourself every day where you live, because that's pretty dangerous. And so maybe then let's pay the investment to remember where we live, so that we can always know that we've got a safe place to go back to. And then there's these long-lasting memories that are valid for the life of the organism. So if you live in close family groups, probably a good idea to immediately remember who your parents are and remember them for very long amounts of time. And so that's where things like we'll talk about imprinting live. So there are different benefits here. It would not make sense to form long-lasting memories of where your next meal is, but it might be a good idea to have long-term memories of where meals tend to be during this time of year. So we match them to time scales. And so this is roughly how I kind of do that, as I think, well, seconds to hours, there's our short term, days to months, there's our long term, months to years to lifetime, there's our long lasting. And then, interestingly enough, innate behavior, you go over this cliff, and if it's over generations, you get rid of memory. So the memory gets more and more costly as it gets longer, but then there's a tipping point where once things are so stable that there's no variation from generation to generation, then you might get a loss of learning. And that's where things become innate behavior. So, and things, there are processes, the time scales can change over time. And so it's possible that earlier versions, in evolutionary history, things might have started at one place and then moved into, they've gotten frozen into another place in order to sort of be less costly. All right. So that's kind of how, from a behavioral ecology perspective, that's how we think about the environment. How stable is the environment? And that helps us map to the cost you're willing to pay in order to do the learning. Questions about that? But for a long time, people have wondered, like, why are humans such good learners? Because most of our environment is relatively stable. And one of the hypotheses is that learning is more about sociality than it is about the everyday goings on of an individual human being. So you have to learn because you live in a world of learners, and there's maybe a positive feedback there that in order to prevent from being tricked by someone else, then you have to learn all of the cues that people are using to trick you and so on and so forth. I'm not saying that that holds up. There are other explanations, but this thing flags things. You're like, wow, this animal's a really good learner. That makes you wonder, oh, so does it live in a very variable environment? And if it doesn't, then what's going on with the learning? Because learning is really costly. That is not something you usually keep around for phylogenetic inertia, because it uses up so much energy. So you'd think you'd lose learning if you didn't need it. So if you have learning, it raises a lot of questions about why you've got it. Okay, so questions about that time scale and the benefits of learning. Okay, all right. So, as you might have noticed, clicker. So let's do this additional clicker here. Like I said, there will be more clickers than usual for reasons that hopefully you'll pick up on. Which type of memory process engages the nucleus of the neuron and reshapes the synapse itself? Is it short-term memory, long-term memory, innate behavior, or reflexes? So go ahead and put your answers into that. So what type of memory actually physically changes the shape of a cell as opposed to just reorganizing parts of the cell? Short-term, long-term, innate behaviors, or reflexes? So hopefully we've learned something. And I see a very strong peak, stronger than the other questions, at B, long-term memory. And that is what I was looking for there. So great. All right. So learning. So we've been talking about that's all the behavioral ecology of learning. Now let's like, how do we classify the types of learning? And so we're going to talk today and on Tuesday about different types of learning. We're going to talk about the simple forms of learning today, more complex forms on Tuesday. So the simple kind of basics you hear in a psychology course and then repeated here, imprinting, habituation and sensitization, or so-called non-associative learning, and associative learning, or conditioning. So those are, let's go through those. So we review for some of you who've taken psych courses. Otherwise, let's just level set and get everybody on the same ground here. So imprinting, it's a kind of an interesting form of learning. Conrad Lorenz, who's one of the kind of founders of behavioral ecology, otherwise sort of an interesting past, basically it would get these ducks that follow them around, and that's because when they were juvenile, then he would insert himself at a so-called critical period, a short defined period of time in the individual's development in which imprinting can take place. And at there's this window of time where the animal has a mechanism where it says, learn who mom or dad is. Learn it now, at this moment in time. And if you insert another individual in there, now for some animals, they have to have certain features. For other animals, it's a little more broad, but he could insert himself in this critical period, and then these baby ducks would follow him around for like their whole development because he had imprinted on them, or I always get those mixed up, which one is which, but he, had taken advantage of imprinting to form a long-lasting memory of him, and they then know that like when whoever's in that slot, that's the resource that you need in order to survive. So follow that person around. So that's imprinting, is that the learning of a critical feature at a critical period, such as the identity of a parent at a young age, and you retain it for almost your whole life. And this is not the normal learning mechanism. There are other developmental mechanisms that are engaged to do imprinting to make this long-lasting work. It is not a cheap form of learning. Because it's a long-lasting type of learning, it involves epigenetics as well. So there's a lot going on there. But the cool thing about it is it doesn't need to be reinforced. You don't forget things that are imprinted on you. It's just, but they can only be imprinted on you during these critical times in development. So that's imprinting, one type of learning, not a very general type of learning. Questions about that? All right. So then there's non-associative learning. So there's a aplysia here, see hair. They're a common model system to study non-associative learning. And when we talk about non-associative learning, we're associating that with habituation and sensitization. So habituation is the loss of a response to a stimulus, usually when the usually relatively low intensity stimulus is given repeatedly. So in the case of a see hair, they have this siphon that pops up out of these gills. And if you tap on this siphon just once, it'll seal up and to protect itself. But if you keep tapping gently at a regular frequency, eventually it habituates to that and it opens up and its siphon comes back out. And that is habituation. Now, this is a little different than another process you'll hear, sensory adaptation. So if there's a constant stimulus, so habituation happens at the central nervous system. So for you and me, the brain. But sensory adaptation is a similar process that happens out in the periphery. So like I might not notice anymore the feel of the shirt on my body because it's like this constant input. And it's like because my nerve endings, my nerves out at the end of the interface between me and the shirt, they end up kind of factoring out that constant input. And so that gives a similar effect, but it's a very different mechanism. We talk about habituation, it is a happening up here in your central nervous system, and you're usually habituating to a more complex signal that just happens to lose its informational value. So initially, this see hair that, is like, I shouldn't be being tapped right now. But then they realize after time that, oh, it's not so bad. And so it just stops noticing that signal. Now, if you're tapping that see hair and then suddenly you whack it really hard, then it will lose its habituation and it will so-called, through this sensitization process. So it will seal back up again and you'll have to tap it lightly again in order to get it to habituate again. So the sudden increase in a response to a stimulus, usually when the stimulus has a relatively high intensity, that's sensitization. So habituation is learning to stop paying attention to a stimulus that has lost its informational value. But then sensitization is learning to start paying attention again. They're not being associated with anything. There's not like associated with reward or reinforcement. There's no punishment that's involved. It's purely attentional and informational. At no point is the see hair harmed or given sugar or benefited, it's just been stimulated. And when that stimulus seems to have no informational value, it stops paying attention to it. And when it's suddenly new and surprising, it starts paying attention again. Questions about that distinction, habituation versus sensitization? but you might habituate to the sound of the projector. You know, it's a complex signal, and if you came in, you might notice it immediately, but after sitting here for a few minutes, then it just like it goes into the background. That's habituation. Question? Okay. So informational filters that help focus the animal on informationally relevant stimuli. So that's what we think the value is. And then the good stuff, or the stuff people are more excited about, associative learning or conditioning. So this is right now, we're staying again within the behaviorism sphere of things. We're going to gradually move into cognition as we get toward the end of this unit, but we're going to start out firmly in behaviorism. And so conditioning is focused on the outside of the animal. It's focused on stimulus. It's focusing on reinforcement, reward. It's focused on response to stimulus. And so we have two types of, so conditioning, a form of learning, which an association is made between two stimuli or between an action and a consequence. And so there are two big names in conditioning. There's Pavlov, classical conditioning, and then there's Skinner, operant conditioning. Lots of other people have played in the space as well. But those are two that were big thinkers early in this. And so if we think about Pavlov's classical conditioning, Pavlov's dog, kind of famous example there, where you get a dog to drool when it hears a bell. So the idea behind classical conditioning is you're copying a response to a stimulus that already is meaningful onto a stimulus which had no meaning. It's the copying of an existing stimulus response relationship. So this is the idea here is that the dog naturally has an unconditioned stimulus, like the smell of food, and has an unconditioned response, drooling, preparing the digestive system for the upcoming food. So that is the original or natural response. There is initially no such response to a neutral stimulus, like hearing a bell. Dog hears a bell. Doesn't do anything. Conditioning, a classical conditioning, will turn that neutral stimulus into a conditioned stimulus by copying the drooling onto the conditioned stimulus. So that's the idea there, is you take an existing stimulus response relationship, you don't change the existing stimulus response relationship, but you add a second stimulus to it. So that either stimulus produces that same response. So it's a little confusing because we call the response to the conditioned stimulus a conditioned response, as if it's another thing. But at least I find that it's easier to think about this as not a new response, but an existing response to an additional stimulus. It's a copy. Is that any questions on that? What do you mean by classical conditioning, what I mean by copying a response. So you have an existing stimulus, an existing response, and you copy it so that an old stimulus that didn't have that response now also responds that way. You don't need to present them both after training, but during the training process, you usually present both. And and over time, they start associating, like if they always drooled when they smelled food, and then the smell of food always is accompanied by that bell, then eventually, if they get just the bell, they'll drool even if there's no smell of food. Questions about that? Pretty clear? Review for some? Okay. Then the other half of it, then there was Skinner. Skinner thought that's great, but it doesn't really explain the complex behaviors we see in nature. And so Skinner thought operant conditioning, this really gets at more interesting phenomenon. So an operant to Skinner is a behavior that results in a consequence that can be learned. So Pavlov was all about stimulus and response, and then Skinner was about operants and consequences. So again, the operant is the behavior that results in a consequence. So the consequence is going to be what we're going to learn is like a reinforcement. So you see a behavior and you reward it or you punish it. So that's what we're going to see here. So the consequences we're talking about are reward, reinforcement, and punishment. Reinforcement is something that causes an animal to do a behavior more than it was doing before. Punishment is something that causes an animal to do a behavior less than it did before. So if it rarely did a behavior and you just happened to catch it doing that behavior once, You can reward it, and then maybe after getting that reward, it will start doing it more often. That's what we mean by reinforcement. If they do it a lot, then every time they do it, you can shock it or flick it or whatever, and then they may stop doing it or do it less. That's what we mean by punishment. Now, there are two ways to do both of those. So this gets a little confusing. There's positive stimuli and negative stimuli. Both of them can be reinforcing or punishing. So a positive stimuli, reinforcement or punishment, comes from the addition of a stimulus. A positive reinforcement is when you're giving something, good. You're giving sugar. A positive punishment is when you're adding something negative. You're snapping the animal with a rubber band, or you're shocking them. So positive punishment is not a positive thing, but it means that the animal was fine and you added the punishment. There's the opposite of that. Negative reinforcement or punishment comes from the removal of a stimulus. So the background of the animal could be that the whole environment is bad. They're just constantly getting shocked. But then they do a behavior and then you remove the shock. So by removing the shock, you actually give them reinforcement to keep doing that behavior. So you can have a negative reinforcement by removing something that is normally bad to give that signal. Likewise, you can have a negative punishment where you can, again, the ultimate goal is to decrease the frequency. So a negative punishment is when you take something away, like you're always rewarding them, you're always giving them just sugar water ad libitum, but then they do something you don't like. So then you take the reward away, and that hopefully reduces the frequency of that behavior. So those are the two categories. Does it increase or decrease the frequency of the behavior? And did you add or remove the stimulus? And you can cross those to get all four combinations. Questions about that? Okay. So Skinner boxes, the classic way to do these experiments. This is sort of a smorgasbord of ways to reinforce and punish an animal. They can get shocked, they can get fed, rewarded. They've got little levers, like the one that I think I've got an image of a mouse pushing a lever. I don't have it on here, I guess, but a little lever that they can push. They get lights that they can respond to. There's loudspeakers. What was that? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. So there's the little lever there that a couple slides back I had a real mouse pushing on that. So lots of stimulus that you can provide, and then reinforcement as well. So common thing you can do there. Now, when we talk about operant conditioning, then we also can talk about whether we're training an animal in a way that sort of is consistent with their evolutionary background. So we can say that an animal can be prepared for the task if it's relevant to their history. So if it involves foraging and smelling for food items, then that's kind of relevant to it. We can say unprepared if that has no relevance, like trying to teach my dog Dexter to do my taxes. This has no background in that. Eventually we'll get him there. But right now he's not very good at it. He just splutes. And then there's contra prepared, where their evolutionary history actually inclines them to do the opposite. So they've normally, had to chase after prey, and now you're teaching them to, protect prey or something like that. It goes completely opposite to whatever their evolutionary history was. So those are the other terms that are associated with operant conditioning. Questions about any of that? Okay. All right, so there's a star that has been showing up in this top left corner. Did anybody notice the star? Anybody? A couple people. Did you notice that those who noticed it, did you notice that there was always an eye clicker question after the star? So some did, some didn't. Those who, I mean, so we're talking about learning curves here, but theoretically, then, if we did this over and over again, eventually, I think a large portion of class would notice that every time an eye clicker was coming up, there'd be a star on the preceding slide. And at that point, you might get your iPhone out or whatever, and you'd get your clicker ready because you know that there'd be a clicker question coming. So, assuming that that's the case, then let's do this quicker question. So, question is, assuming that was the case, that the star happened before every clicker question, if you notice that and you got your phone out and preparing for the clicker question, then, if you've done that, if you notice the star before that, then what paradigm in the classical conditioning paradigm, the Pavlovian paradigm, what would we call the star that I've added before every eye clicker slide? Would we call that the unconditioned stimulus, the unconditioned response, the conditioned stimulus, or the conditioned response? So go ahead and try that. But remember, I don't normally have the star. The clicker question pops up, you get your phone out. I've added a star, and then now you see the star and you get your phone out. So is the star an unconditioned stimulus, an unconditioned response, a conditioned stimulus, or conditioned response? Let's see how that turned out. We've got a huge mode at C, conditioned stimulus. And the rationale here, it's probably not a response because I gave it to you. You're the response. You got your phone out. But whether it's conditioned or unconditioned, remember the unconditioned response is the thing you just naturally do. This slide without the star, that is our unconditioned stimulus. The new thing that I added that now you get your phone out when you either see the star or see this slide, that is the conditioned stimulus. So I was looking for that. Conditioned stimulus, DS. So good job there. All right. This is what we covered today. It's a lot, lot to learn. So good job. And that's, keep in mind this weekend, do the Unit B stuff. Next weekend it'll be Unit C stuff. And that's all I've got for you. So any questions, feel free to come up. Otherwise, have a nice weekend. You too.